an extraordinary abdication of American leadership. It is a shameful moment for the United States.
The president said so memorably yesterday. He was elected to represent Pittsburgh, not Paris.
Pulling out of this climate agreement is a huge and reckless choice.
We all share the same responsibility. Make our planet great again.
The president has said routinely he's going to put the interest of American citizens at the head of his administration. And he did that with respect to his decision yesterday on Paris.
EPA Chief Scott Pruitt defending the U.S. withdrawal from the Paris Climate Agreement. Before that, we heard French President Emmanuel Macron, California Senator Dianne Feinstein, Vice President Mike Pence, and former Secretary of State John Kerry. Around the world, in this country, maybe in your own home or at work, there are strongly held opinions about climate change and whether or not Paris is a good idea. The American exit is either a horrifying abdication of American leadership, as we just heard John Kerry say, or it's a forceful and long overdue statement about U.S. sovereignty. That was definitely the case on the John and Ken show over on KFI AM 640.
Apparently, the U.S. has pulled out of the climate deal that was made in Paris at the end of 2015.
No,
Obama's
no,
legacy is squashed.
Oh, no! We're all going to die! Here comes the ocean! We're all going to drown!
All right, well, John Cobalt is the John of John and Ken, and he's here now. Hi there.
You make me sound crazy.
I don't make you sound crazy.
I make me sound crazy.
All right, so most of your listeners are Trump supporters. Tell us more about their take on what he said yesterday.
To be honest, we didn't take a whole lot of calls from people on this, but in general, they're looking at Trump as looking out for them. And all the things that he promised he would do so far when it came to trade, immigration, global agreements that would hurt jobs here, that's one of the big reasons they voted for him in spite of all the other nonsense that surrounds him every day. They're looking at their world changing dramatically over the last 25 years, and they want somebody to stop it, and they don't care who. Mm-hmm. And he's living up to those campaign promises.
And so what about climate change, though, and the environment? Where does that rank on their list of concerns?
It doesn't.
At all?
No. No. There's never I'll give you an example. We run all kinds of articles on our Facebook feed, uh-huh. Sometimes different than what we do on the air. And there was one the other day about how global warming is going to make you lose sleep. And the idea was, as the earth warms, you're going to be more uncomfortable, so you'll sleep less. And a guy wrote a response on Facebook that said, you know what keeps me up at night? The California Air Resources Board has new regulations on my fleet of trucks, and I have to buy a whole new fleet, and I can't afford it. So I'm up at night worrying about how am I going to buy a new set of trucks. And, mm-hmm. and so that's what a lot of people think about. I don't think they're particularly interested what the world's temperature is going to be in the year 2100. All this guy knows is the government just took his fleet of trucks away, and he doesn't have the money to buy new ones.
Right. So they're thinking about their immediate pocketbook concerns.
Well, yeah. What is often broadcast on the news networks and cable television is not the set of issues that the average guy is caring about. You can get 3 million listeners on or viewers on CNN by screaming about Russians, screaming about global warming. There's another 327 million people out there, and a lot of them don't care about this stuff. And I think the media is having a hard time understanding this, that there are more guys who are losing their jobs or having their business impacted by global warming and trade agreements than they care about, you know, some Russians making phone calls to Jared Kushner.
Right. What a lot of people are saying, look, you know, this is a changing world. And when it comes to global warming, looking at it from an economic perspective, when you change over to clean technology, there are all these jobs, all these new jobs in California in particular. And so many economists are saying this is actually a good thing to do, to be in Paris and to push forward these new clean technologies from an economic point of view.
Well, according to an MIT study, which the EPA uses, if all 195 countries agree to follow all the tenets of what's in this accord, it's going to shave 0.2 degrees off global warming by 2100. Now, that's assuming you believe that scientists can measure 0.2 degrees 83 years from now. let's say they can. According to a report by the American Council for Capital Formation, funded by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, this could cost us 6.5 million industrial jobs and maybe $3 trillion to the economy. Now we should have a debate, and we don't have this debate. If it's three trillion, and if it's 6.5 million jobs in industry, and we're getting 0.2 degrees 83 years from now, is that a good deal? Or maybe this ought to be aired out a little bit?
Hmm. Yeah, well, that study has been disputed by many other economists. And
everybody disputes everything now.
Right, but the MIT study has been updated by the same scientists, and they concluded that it'll actually be a degree, not 2/10, but 1 degree.
I just looked at PolitiFact, and they agreed that it is a 0.2 degree.
But even if it is 0.2 degree, that could, by the estimate of many scientists, result in some serious environmental changes, major heat waves and ocean warming.
Does that seem right to you, though? Again, look at it from...
Well, I'm not a scientist. So.
Well, none of us are, and certainly the voters aren't, and the Trump supporters aren't, and the Hillary supporters are. None of us are scientists. But you kind of have to use the common sense test sometime. You're talking about 0.2 degree that will change over the course of 83 years. That sounds, and that's assuming they're absolutely right. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't have that much faith in anything to say 0.2 degree in 83 years. Yeah, that's absolutely solid. I just flat out don't believe they can predict to that level of specificity. And most people don't. And by the way, we're all going to be dead in 83 years.
We don't care about future generations?
Most people care about their current generation and their kids. But if you're asking them to care about 3 or 4 generations down the road, no, they don't. It's just not in human nature.
Right. It's a tough sell. So yeah. Politically, getting back to the political question, what do you think this is going to do for Donald Trump?
I think he came through on a promise for his followers. And so he's stacking them up. You know, he's actually taking concrete action on illegal immigration. He pulled out of that Asian trade agreement. He's now pulled out of the Paris Accord. By the way, he said this out loud many, many times and was derided and mocked all along the way for it. And he did it. I imagine, can't prove this, that people are saying, well, look at that. He's taking action. He's doing what he said he would do. And he's doing what I wanted him to do. The truck driver who wrote to us, he's probably pretty happy today because maybe that reverses the tide a little bit. And maybe someday down the road, he's not going to have the California government replacing his fleet without giving him the money to pay for it.
All right, John, it was great talking with you.
All right. Thanks very much.
My pleasure. That's John Cobalt. He is host of John and Ken on KFI AM 640. Let's bring in now Josh Barrow, senior editor at Business Insider and host of KCRW's politics show Left, Right, and Center. Welcome back, Josh.
Thanks, Madeline.
Okay, so that's the view from the Trump side, the Trump supporter side. What do you think his speech yesterday is going to do for him politically?
Well, I mean, I think in terms of the politics, I think John has it largely right there, which is to say that I think climate change is a fairly low salience issue for most voters. About 2% of people tell Gallup that they see it as the most important issue facing the United States today. And I think that when you face people with this trade-off between long-run environmental benefits and short-term economic effects for them, I think that people, especially given the sluggish economic growth that the whole Western world has faced over the last 15 years, I think people are not in a mood to incur costs now for benefits down the road. Now, that said, I think pulling out of this agreement means a little bit less than either the agreement's supporters say or that its detractors say, which is to say, I mean, this agreement was non-binding. It allowed the participating countries to set their own targets, and then there was no penalty if you didn't meet the targets. And so I think, you know, what we'll see other countries do, Trump pulling out of the agreement seems to have actually produced a significant amount of global backlash. I don't think there's a reason to believe that our pulling out will cause countries to be less committed to fighting climate change. In fact, it might make it more politically tenable to take economically costly actions in places like France to say to people, well, we need to move toward renewable energy because Donald Trump won't do it in the United States. Mm-hmm. And then domestically in the U.S., the factors that have been slowing greenhouse gas emissions in the U.S., some of it is not public policy at all. We've had, you know, the technological improvement in natural gas production through fracking, which is the main factor that's been driving coal-fired power plants out of business. That trend will continue and will tend to reduce the amount of coal that we're burning. And then a lot of the renewable energy stuff that we've been doing has been reaching a scale where it's becoming economically self-sustainable. So a lot of that will continue regardless of what Donald Trump does on it. And then you have significant efforts at the state and local level that are pushing changes to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. So I don't think that this move even has that large an effect on what sort of emissions we'll produce in the United States. Now, there are other things the Trump administration is doing, trying to unwind some of the EPA rules that President Obama had put in place on power plant emissions. That could have some effect. But again, you know, if you're a power utility deciding whether to build a new coal plant, you're not just concerned about what President Trump is going to do. You're looking, you know, over a period of decades about what public policy is likely to be. I don't think people are too inclined to invest in infrastructure to burn a lot of coal in the United mm-hmm. States.
Yeah, forward. And then plus you're also negotiating with states and state regulators and when
exactly.
you're doing that. Okay, so, but in terms of the politics and the optics of this, he comes off his big trip to Europe and in the Middle East and definitely is sticking his thumb in the eye of Europe in the speech yesterday. And he actually says, I represent Pittsburgh, not Paris, which is a great line, aside from the fact that the voters of Pittsburgh voted for Hillary Clinton. But mm-hmm. so in terms of that, are you seeing a resurgence of the Steve Bannon wing of the White House?
Well, I'm not sure, because I think part of the, you know, I think Donald Trump wanted to pull out of this agreement as a symbol of his desire to unencumber the United States from global commitments. But I think there's a reason that he pulled out of this, and that he, for example, you know, he talked about the idea that he would file notice that the U.S. would withdraw from the North American Free Trade Agreement, and then he chickened out of that. He was talked out of it by advisors. Instead, we're going to tinker around the margins with it. We remain so far officially committed to NATO. So I think, you know, the idea that we were going to fundamentally reorient the U.S. in a more isolationist America First direction, the substantive opportunities he's had on that, he hasn't really taken. This one was a good symbolic opportunity for him to thumb his nose at the world because the agreement was itself so symbolic.
Mm.
He could pull out of the agreement without large direct policy effects, without alienating significant Republican constituencies in the way that he would have, for example, by pulling out of NAFTA.
Right.
So I think it's a symbolic win for the Bannon wing, but I think there's a reason what they're getting is symbolism. I don't think yet we're seeing, you know, if we're going to have a new protectionist approach to trade, for example, it's not in evidence yet under President Trump.
Well, we are all talking about Paris and the environment, and we're not talking about Russia. So next week, is that going to change?
Well, James Comey is testifying before Congress on Thursday. So I think, you know, he won't answer every question that's put to him. There are going to be some topic areas where I think Robert Mueller, the special prosecutor, is going to want Comey to hold back information. Mueller wants to do his interviews first before Comey talks publicly about those. But we will hear from Comey about his meetings with the president, what he saw the president as pressuring him to do or not to do. And then, of course, you have all this stuff with Jared Kushner and the back channel. And I think we're going to continue to see more information about that. You know, initially there's been a lot of leaking. Joe Scarborough on MSNBC this morning was suggesting that some of that leaking is coming from the Bannon side in the White House, trying to undermine Jared Kushner. And then over time, we're going to see subpoenas. We're going to see actual work product from these investigations. So, I think people will be talking a lot about that going forward. And I disagree with John a little bit about that people don't care about this. I think, you know, it's sort of like the email server story. It's not like people were telling pollsters that was the number one thing that they were concerned about in the election, but it really took its toll on Hillary Clinton through the course of the campaign. And I think we see Donald Trump's approval numbers are bad. They've been getting steadily worse through his presidency, and I think this is one of the things that's eating at him.
Josh, thanks.
Thank you.
Josh Barrow, senior editor at Business Insider and host of KCRW's Left, Right, and Center, which you can hear tonight at 7 o'clock. And before that, though, I want to hear from you. You've had a day to process Trump's decision to pull out of Paris. How are you thinking about it now? You can weigh in on our Facebook page at KCRW Press Play. Well, the spotlight is now on what states and cities are doing to limit global warming. California has some of the country's strictest regulations on greenhouse gas emissions. Its cap and trade program sets limits for emissions, and businesses must buy permits if they exceed those limits. Well, last night, facing a deadline on that and many other issues, California state lawmakers debated the future of the cap and trade program. What did pass? A goal for California to reach 100% renewable energy by 2045, but no extension for the cap and trade program beyond the year 2020. John Myers is following all the action. He is the Sacramento Bureau Chief for the LA Times. Hi, John.
Hi.
Okay, so clear this up. The cap and trade program failed to be extended. Why?
Well, I mean, it's really politics. I mean, and it is policy too, Madeline, but I mean, there's a lot of politics here. I mean, as you said a moment ago, this is the mechanism that California uses to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. This is the marquee part of the law that's been on the books for a long time. There is more consensus now than I have ever seen in Sacramento about extending cap and trade beyond its current lifespan. It's supposed to go at least until the year 2020 under current law. For a while, there was no consensus about that. The business community was up in arms. Business community actually sued the state of California about cap and trade, saying it was an illegal tax.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a lot of consensus about extending that. The problem is, how do you get there? There are a number of Democrats from what are really kind of being called now the environmental justice community. These are often lawmakers from low-income communities in California. They want the state to not only look at the broad goals, but to do more about specific sites, specific industries, and about air pollution. And so the effort last night really linked these two issues. It linked these notions of capping down on pollutions with extending cap and trade, but it didn't go anywhere. There are differences in the Democratic caucuses in Sacramento. You've got more business-aligned Democrats and others who said, look, you know, the pollution goals are good, but let's don't put them in this bill. And the bill failed. This is only a first test of this, though, I would point out to people. Okay. We've got another 3 months in Sacramento to talk about cap and trade, and I think we're going to keep talking about it a lot.
Okay. Exciting. More talk about cap and trade. All right. But what else they did was they passed this bill that would have California run on 100% renewable energy by 2045. That seems major.
Yeah, it's a very big, ambitious goal. I mean, this would mean that all the power would come from things like solar or wind power. It is easily the most ambitious program in the world. And again, this has only cleared one part of the legislature, the state Senate. It now goes to the Assembly and the governor, though there's a lot of consensus on this one, I think. It would speed up the state's goal of reaching, in addition to all renewable energy, that we would have to get to 50% renewable faster than we have to now. There's already a place in law for that. The question is how do you get there? You had Republicans in the legislature saying, look, the technological capacity is not there. And really, the bill sets a lot of goals, and then it says regulators and the energy industry has to come up with it. But the argument in favor of this is that we're already getting to these goals faster than we ever have. And again, this is a push from Governor Brown and Democrats in the state that say, we want to be the leader on dealing with climate change and reducing our emissions. And they certainly have been saying that, Madeline, in the last 24 hours more than they have.
Mm-hmm.
And that this is one of the ways to get there. Make us more fully reliant on renewable energy in almost every instance.
Okay, let's switch to health care. One unexpected moment last night was a vote in the Senate on the single-payer health care bill. How did that come about?
Well, how it came about is this has become a very popular issue in Democratic circles right now. In the wake of the presidential campaign and a lot of liberal activism in the party, that single-payer health care that is completely government-run, where you put all the money from the private sector and all the other pots of money into one place and the government has this control, this is a big popular idea. And so the bill passed. The challenge is that the bill doesn't have a funding mechanism in it yet. I mean, this is really the beginning of a discussion. There's a lot of symbolism about this. The estimates of what this would cost in California, somewhere in the neighborhood of $350 to $400 billion. That is an enormous amount of money. you know, listeners should understand that what I'm talking about here is even if you and I get health care through our employer now, we would be in the system. There would be no more mm-hmm. of that traditional private insurance. So some of this money is already being spent on health care, but there would be new taxes out of this. And the bill does not identify what those taxes are yet. And that's what's fascinating. The bill passes one of the houses of the legislature without that funding in place. This is a big Democratic priority, and I think it's going to be really, really interesting to see, can some of these details get fleshed out here in the next few weeks and months? And then what does the governor do? The governor's already said it's too expensive. Is this really more symbolism than policy? I think we'll see.
Right. Okay. Bail reform. A bill failed in the assembly, but I guess that issue's not dead now.
It's not dead because there are two different versions of this out there. This is a longstanding debate that the most vulnerable people in California, the poor, they have the hardest time dealing with what happens if they are brought in and they are brought into the legal system. You know, this would let more nonviolent offenders in California wait for their trial at home instead of behind bars. It would ask the counties to come up with a better system to help the courts determine when people are arrested if they're a risk to public safety, and not have to necessarily have them spend thousands of dollars on bail that they often don't get back. The challenge is, of course, is that you've got a law and order contingent who says, we don't want to let people out, we want to hold people's feet to the fire. And you've also got a very influential bail industry that mm-hmm. makes money off of the bail system. There was a defeat last night, but there was a green light in the state Senate, a defeat in the assembly. This one's going to keep getting worked on. It's fascinating, Madeline. Everybody says they should take another look at the system, but how you get there remains to be seen.
Okay. Now, some interesting ones. Third gender. The Senate passed a bill to add a non-binary gender on official documents like driver's licenses. I think this would be the first in the nation.
Yeah, first in the nation, and a fascinating discussion here, too, as we've had so many of these discussions in the last few years, basically making this a non-binary choice on these documents, and that it would therefore also simplify the process if someone changed their gender on a document in the future. Again, the kind of conversation that shows just how far we have come in a small amount of time to talk about issues of gender in California and the country. California was the leader before, and this one has got a lot of momentum, it looks like, to continue to be the leader.
Okay, here's another one where it could be the leader: ending daylight saving time.
Boy, we've gone from topic to topic. So yeah, this one is amazing. And I, you know, as the parent of two small children, I hate when the clocks change because the kids just don't seem to believe it. This bill simply has been around for a while, Madeline. This bill simply says, look, let California stop changing the clock. It's somewhat agnostic on whether or not we would stay on standard time or daylight saving time, although if we were to stay on the extended daylight time, the federal government would have to get involved. The bottom line here is, even if this bill moves forward, and it did pass the assembly last night, even if it moves forward, it has to go to a vote of the people. I bet you didn't know that.
No, I didn't know that. In 1949,
California voters approved daylight saving time. Because the voters had a role before, the voters would have to have a role again. So, you know, tell the listeners, if you want to get involved in daylight savings time debates, it could be on the ballot in 2018.
Okay. I'm very excited about that. John Myers, Sacramento Bureau Chief for the LA Times. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thanks.
All right. Let's hear from you. Yes or no on ending daylight saving time. You can weigh in on our Facebook page at KCRW Press Play, or also Twitter, same address, at KCRW Press Play. Coming up, why the Supreme Court may finally have the opportunity to overturn the World War II era decision that led to the internment of Japanese Americans. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. The Trump administration wants the Supreme Court to decide soon whether the travel ban is legal. It has asked the court to immediately overturn a decision by the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals. As with so many cases that go before the court these days, Justice Anthony Kennedy is likely to be the swing vote. And one close court watcher has written that Justice Kennedy may see this case as an opportunity. That court watcher is Richard Primus, law professor at the University of Michigan. Welcome.
Hi, happy to be here. And by the way, I grew up in South Bend, Indiana, where we never changed the clocks, so you can look to us for precedent.
Are you a happier man because of it?
I don't know, but I'm pretty happy, so it's not so bad.
Okay, so you write that this case could be, quote, an opportunity to do one of the things that he, Anthony Kennedy, most loves to do. And what is that?
It's to correct the historical record, to redeem errors that the court has made in the past. Justice Kennedy, maybe even more so than most Supreme Court justices, is deeply invested in the grand narrative of American constitutional history. The court is the chief narrator of that history. And there have been times in the past when the court has made decisions that are later seen as terrible. And Kennedy has written a number of opinions going back and cleaning them up. That is to say, saying, we fully repudiate this prior decision. He did it with Plessy versus Ferguson, which is the 1896 case upholding segregation. There's a Kennedy opinion from the early 90s in which he famously wrote, Plessy was wrong the day it was decided. And then he did it again with a case called Bowers versus Hardwick, which was the case in the 1980s upholding the criminalization of same-sex sexual relationships. And the Kennedy opinion that overruled that one said, again, Bowers was wrong the day it was decided. This is pretty strong language for the Supreme Court criticizing itself. I can imagine an opinion that says Korematsu was wrong the day it was decided.
Okay, so Korematsu, this is the case, 1944 case, that basically gave legal justification for the internment of Japanese Americans, correct?
Correct. Retrospectively, that is to say the camps were already running and had actually just been closed. But yes, the Supreme Court signed off on it and said this policy was constitutional.
And why, in the 73 years or so since, has it not been repudiated or overturned?
Well, the reason it hasn't been overruled is chiefly that the court hasn't seen cases that would be occasions for overruling it. To have an occasion for overruling the case, you'd have to have a case in which the government was doing something like what it did in that previous case. And since the 40s, the federal government hasn't engaged in that kind of blatant, overt racism much. The court hasn't had the opportunity.
And you think that this is an opportunity right now?
I do. I think the case has been argued in the courts on the theory that the travel ban is purposeful discrimination by the administration, which it pretty clearly is, and that's what makes it unconstitutional. And it's purposeful discrimination in a realm that resembles the Korematsu case, though obviously presents different issues. There are different moral issues involved, there are different policy issues involved, but it smells a little bit like Korematsu because it's the government looking at a marginal demographic group and saying, there's a big security threat that comes from this group, and then taking a purposefully discriminatory action against them. If the court wanted finally to say, Korematsu was wrong, and we want to expunge that stain on our institution, or at least fully apologize for it, this is the best opportunity they've had, maybe ever.
But Kennedy has in the past said that courts should defer to the executive branch on decisions on immigration in the absence of an affirmative showing of bad faith.
Yes, that's right. And a lot of people are saying that that is an indication that he might go the other way. But I think that argument misses something really important. The whole premise of the challenger's argument in this case is that the administration is acting in bad faith. Right? The bad faith is pretty simple. Their motive is discriminatory, but they don't admit to that motive. They say that they don't mean to be discriminating against Muslims. If that's what they say, but the courts believe that really they do mean to be discriminating against Muslims, which is what the courts have said, that means the administration is in bad faith, which means this case is exactly the kind of case about which Kennedy has previously said, here I don't defer. Come in and lie to me, I don't defer.
And so he would have to take the comments that Donald Trump made during the campaign into consideration.
Well, you know, that would make it easy, but I actually don't think he would have to. I think there's enough evidence on the record to indicate a discriminatory purpose, even if courts look only at things that happened after the election. Some of those things are in the travel ban itself, because the way the travel ban is structured doesn't really make sense as a way to implement the policy that they want. And sometimes when courts look at an order and say, so government, what are you trying to do here? And the government explains its purpose, and the courts look at the order and say, yeah, this doesn't actually achieve that purpose. It's a signal that there's a hidden motive going on. And in addition to that, both the president and other administration members have said things since the election that, you know, pretty reasonably are taken to indicate anti-Muslim bias and anti-Muslim reasons for enacting this order. So although I think that it would be appropriate to take also into account things from before the election, because the question the court is trying to answer is why did he do this? And lots of things can be relevant for that. It isn't necessary in this case. There's enough evidence even without it.
Okay, so what's the timeline here? I know the term is ending pretty soon this month. So when will they have to make a decision?
Well, I think they'll make a decision on whether to hear the case within a week or two. If the case goes through normal channels, that means it wouldn't be heard until October. There's always the chance that if they do decide to hear the case, they'll hear it on an emergency basis, and then it could be heard by the end of June. And there's just no telling at this point which of those things they'll do if they agree to hear the case at all.
Richard Primus, law professor at the University of Michigan. Thank you.
Happy to be here.
Coming up, I hope you know that music. The much-anticipated Wonder Woman movie is here, directed by a Wonder Woman.
She's the first female director in any of the superhero franchises to helm a movie this big, which is exciting because it means she's probably going to break the record this weekend for the biggest opening by a female director ever.
We'll review that and other new movies. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand.
I used to want to save the world. This beautiful place. But the closer you get, the more you see the great darkness within.
Well, there's been a lot of darkness lately, but there's light and beauty, too, because it's Friday and time for movie reviews. Tim Gerson is here, senior U.S. critic for Screen International. Hello.
Hello.
And Amy Nicholson, chief film critic for MTV News and host of the podcast The Canon. Hello.
Hello.
Okay, we really need a superhero this week, and I'm glad it's a lady. And so what did you guys think? This movie stars Gal Gadot and Chris Pine and Robin Wright.
I think it's really darn good. I was very pleasantly surprised because the DC universe has been pretty terrible of late. Batman versus Superman and Suicide Squad were both pretty terrible. Godot plays Wonder Woman, and it's an origin story about how she comes to Earth and basically fights the Germans with the help of Chris Pine, who's an American undercover agent. It's just a really well-made, smart, funny action movie. I think that's like the real difference between this and some of the other kind of DC movies we've had. This one's actually really funny. It's got a great love story between the two of them. This is a very pleasant surprise, I think.
Okay, here's a clip of her meeting Chris Pine.
Have you never met a man before? I mean, what about your father?
I had no father. I was brought to life by Zeus.
Well, that's neat.
There's some good timing there. So, Amy, tell us the backstory here.
Right. So this is Patty Jenkins' huge blockbuster debut. She's the first female director in any of the superhero franchises to helm a movie this big, which is exciting because it means she's probably going to break the record this weekend for the biggest opening by a female director ever, which the bittersweet part of that is it's not super hard to beat. The biggest opening for a female so far has been $81 million for 50 Shades of Grey. She can do that. I mean, Batman versus Superman opened to $160 million and that had terrible reviews. But Wonder Woman is amazing. I mean, I wish we had her in 2017 fighting the world we have to, but she's back in this movie on the battlefields of 1918 when there's a equally bad conflict going on, World War I. And what I liked so much about Patty Jenkins' approach is, you know, this is just almost a harkening back to the original Christopher Reeve Superman. You know, it doesn't feel like this dark, twisted Zack Snyder world where everybody has mommy issues. I mean, she doesn't have a dad, as you clearly just heard.
Dad issues. Yeah, or no issues.
But she doesn't even seem to care about that. It's fine. She's here to do good and to fight and to be loving among this lesser species, kind of like Christopher Reeve looking around and saying, I will do what I can for these people. They also have to help themselves. I can't save every cat in every tree.
Right. And so is she kind of dorky the way Christopher Reeve was?
She's innocent. I mean, to me, she feels like Daryl Hannah in Splash, but with a giant sword.
And a giant shield as well. Yeah, I think the Superman analogy is really good because she just sort of believes the best in people. And what's great about her relationship with Chris Pine, and as the movie goes along, is she realizes she actually thinks much better of humanity than humanity itself does. And so kind of like with Superman, Wonder Woman is sort of this model of she thinks the best of us. Why can't these people live up to the same idea? And that's, I think, one of the things that's really strong in the movie is that the characters that she meets are like, well, she's such a good person. Maybe we should be as good as she is. It's, you know, like the original Christopher Reeve Superman, it's such a aspirational movie. There's no cynicism about it. There's not that darkness, that brooding that's been so much part of the DC movies. So, yeah, it's a real kind of like just like an up watching this movie.
And how is Gal Gadot, the Israeli actress?
You know, in my review, I said that she reminded me of a high school soccer star. She's just clean. She has a French braid. She looks really tough, and she's very self-confident. There's not a lot of depth to what she's doing. I mean, I think the cynicism might come because she's realizing that men are awful by the end of the movie, but maybe she'll love them anyways. So she gets to play it just wholesome, and I like that about her. Like, they don't give her a ton of wrenching scenes, and she can just nail what she needs to do. They shoot her like she's this marble statue goddess. She just looks so strong when she walks into the room, and everybody stops and turns around.
Okay, moving on to a movie about another superhero. And this one, well, he doesn't wear that much. His name is Captain Underpants. And this is from DreamWorks Animation. It stars Kevin Hart, Thomas Middleditch, Ed Helms. Here's a clip.
When I snap my fingers, you will obey our every command. You are now the amazing Captain Underpants!
Tra-la-la!
I honestly didn't think that would happen.
Okay, so these two kids, this is based on the children's book series, immensely popular, and they turn their principal into Captain Underpants.
Yeah, that clip basically sets up the entire conceit of the movie. And, you know, I'm not that familiar with the books, to be honest. The movie is about 85 minutes long, and it's about the right length, I feel like, for this thing. It is, I think, like a lot of animated kids' movies, they're very kind of manic. And like you feel like there's like this like sugar high. What's fun about Captain Underpants in comparison is that it's just really kind of cheerful and fun. I mean, it's got like its crazy elements to it. I mean, you have Kevin Hart in the movie, for crying out loud. It's going to be kind of that kind of thing.
Manic.
But it's much more like cheery and fun and silly. I mean, the bad guy's name is Professor Poopy Pants, and he's played by Nick Kroll, who's really funny. He like affects this like crazy German accent. I wouldn't say it's a great movie, but it's a very, very fun, sweet, kind of counter-programming summer kids movie.
What's the age range here?
I saw it with a bunch of grade schoolers, and the kids in the movie, the two best friends, are in fourth grade. And I would say it's more kind of grade school-y than even, like, say, junior high kind of thing. They seem pretty occupied by the movie and were enjoying it, but there's a lot of, like, fart humor and people falling down and stuff like that. It's not great, but I think it's, especially for that age group, what they usually have to deal with, like say with Minions and stuff like this, this is a far superior kind of kids movie.
And this is the first epic movie, apparently, so
yeah,
there
so
will be more.
Fingers crossed, I think, over at Fox, they're hoping that there'll be more of them. Yeah, I would happily see another one, put it that way.
You would.
I would.
You are not in the demo.
I am not
saying you're not youthful looking, but
I appreciate it. No, I would gladly take my god kids to see this.
Gotcha.
Absolutely.
Okay, let's shift gears now. Our last movie is called Band-Aid. It's written, directed, and stars Zoe Lister-Jones. Let's listen to a bit of it.
It's one dish.
One dish.
You happen to be quite the dish Nazi, I might add.
When did you... Everything is like, this is not clean.
That's super offensive, because I come from a long line of Holocaust survivors.
How could there be a long line of Holocaust survivors?
Okay, so this, Amy, is about a couple who are on the rocks and they form a band?
It is, yeah. This film is written and directed and stars Zoe Lister-Jones, who a lot of people know from TV. She had a big arc in The New Girl. She's a great comedian. And this is a kind of indie romantic comedy, very Echo Park, Silver Lake, that world, about this couple who has been together for so long, they're fighting so much about the dishes that they form a band called The Dirty Dishes. And they play songs that, to me, I don't know, Tim is more of a music guy than I am. They sound like early B-52s, just people kind of yelling at each other on the microphones about everything wrong with their relationship.
Is the music good, Tim?
I think the music's okay. I, not to jump in, but I think that the music is okay. I think it's more about the idea of what the lyrics are and what they're, as Amy was saying, they're kind of working through their issues by singing lyrics back and forth to each other. What we discover is that the couple are fighting about a lot of things, but the main thing is that they're still getting over the fact that they had a miscarriage. And that's actually the thing that's underneath everything. And so the songs are about them fighting about dishes or doing this or not doing that, but that's underlying everything. And there's a lot of stuff I really liked about this movie, but as Amy was saying, the Silver Lake Echo Park-ness and also the Sundance-iness of this movie.
Where this was one of the biggest hits of this year's Sundance. It was such a crowd pleaser compared to everything else.
And I feel like it's a little too simple in its humor. I think there's like a smarter, tougher movie in there, and they settle for more of the Portlandy kind of comedy. Fred Armisen plays their next door neighbor, who is their drummer. He is a super quirky character. And I think in general, the movie is a little too quirky for my taste.
Yeah, I wanted to like it a lot more than I did. Although there was much I really respected. I like Zoe Lister-Jones a lot. I think she's somebody I want to watch. I want to really keep my eye on her. And Adam Pally as her husband is also really good. What I didn't know watching it, and I only realized recently, is that she shot this film with an all-female crew.
Right.
Literally everybody
on set. She even banned men from being on set, I heard.
Exactly. I mean, so maybe she and Patty Jenkins could team up and be like, what should we do next? I mean, she's actually come out and said, Zoe Lister-Jones, that she would love to do a superhero movie. I mean, I really hated the subplot about their fertility woes because I think we've seen that in every film about a couple lately. It's always revealed in the second act as this big revelation. And you know, when you have Angelina Jolie screaming about it in the rain with Brad Pitt a couple years ago, I think I'm done with that. But the film,
you know where that ended up.
Exactly. But well, I hope people give this a chance, you know, a judicious chance.
But there does seem to be a whole raft of these movies / TV shows taking place in Echo Park, Silver Lake.
Right.
Involving, I don't know, the neuroses of 30-something-year-old white people.
Who are also aspiring artists at the same time. I mean, I don't want to diminish the issues that the couple have, because I think that's the most interesting stuff. But it is a milieu that we've sort of seen, like you said, Madeline, where it is about people in their 30s who are artists and life hasn't exactly worked out. And
yet they live in these amazing houses.
And they live in a very nice house.
Looking at real estate prices, how is that possible?
We're on the same wavelength. That's exactly some of my issues with it. And it's sometimes, I think, unfair to criticize it, but you notice it in a movie like this, that in a lot of ways they have problems, but they could have much worse problems. And the movie doesn't seem to really, I think, own up to that. I think a lot of the stuff about how couples deal with their problems and how they talk about things and how they talk around their issues. I think all of that, you know, as a married person, I relate to it. I think it's dead on. I just wish the whole world of the movie was better. Also, Zoe Lister-Jones co-wrote a lot of the songs. So, I mean, I think she's definitely sort of a force to be reckoned with and someone to kind of keep an eye on. But this to me feels like a first movie. I'm very curious what comes after this for her.
Well, it's so interesting that in our real world, things are so big and massive and people are so consumed, many people consumed with these large issues, and we get these movies about small worlds.
Yeah, I wonder if in a year from the election, we're going to start seeing these people making movies where they're carrying signs and fighting over politics. Well, I mean, what if her husband was a Bernie bro?
Oh my gosh.
It's a possibility.
Then
I have
the
to say.
Would be over.
I am Pally's character does seem slightly Bernie Bro-ish in certain ways in this movie. So trigger warning, I guess, for some audience members.
All right. Thanks, you guys. Tim Grierson, senior U.S. critic for Screen International. Amy Nicholson, chief film critic for MTV News and host of the podcast The Canon. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Coming up on this program, Mr. Met. You may know him. He flipped off a fan. Mike Pesca has some questions like, how can you flip someone off with just four fingers? We'll have that next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. These are dark days for fans of the New York Mets. They're 10 games in back of Washington in the National League East, but we're not talking about that. It's kind of good for the Mets historically. No, we're going to talk about the epic fall from grace of the Mets baseball-headed mascot, Mr. Met. That's just 3 seconds of video posted on Twitter. It got Mr. Met into big trouble. Walking down the ramp to the clubhouse, he turned and gave the guy filming the finger. Well, on this story, there is just one man capable of providing the kind of analysis and insight we expect here on Press Play, and that is Mike Pesca, host of the podcast The Gist. And not only a Mets fan, he spent some time inside the costume of a sailor. Yeah, he was a mascot at Oceanside High School on Long Island. Hi, Mike.
Mm-hmm. Hi. It was Popeye. It was modeled after Popeye the Sailor, and his head was perfectly round, just like the orb atop Mr. Met's shoulders. So I have a lot of sympathy for the guy.
So you're on Mr. Met's side. He didn't look too happy when he gave the fan the finger.
Okay, a couple things. We are quintiphilangelists insofar as we have five fingers, you and I. Mr. Met only has four fingers, or if you want to be technical, three fingers and a thumb. So it is impossible for him to give the middle finger if you only have four fingers. Giving the middle finger would be just a space of air. Therefore, perhaps in the language of the humanoid Mr. Met, that fourth finger that he was giving, or, you know, the second finger, I guess, on his hand, might have a different meaning. I'm just putting this out there in the spirit of, say, Sarah Huckabee Sanders trying to explain another large-headed man from Queens with an ill temper.
So maybe he was sticking his first finger up, like to say, we're number one. Is that what you're trying to say?
That would be the worst thing he could do. That would be the most provocative to a Mets fan.
Well, plus it's a lie, so there's
yeah, that. They are far from number one. So the Mets started the season with just a surfeit of great pitchers, and one by one they got hurt or stayed hurt. And so now the once promising Mets season, they were in the World Series 2 years ago, they were going to get all their pitchers back. They've really fallen on tough times, as often happens to the Mets. And there's been one constant throughout everything associated with the Mets. There's been one lodestar. There's been one bright point, and that is Mr. Met. He is unsullied. He is really the brand ambassador and just about the best asset they have as the Mets. In all honesty, when the owners were trying to dig out from the Bernie Madoff scandal, if you remember that, they were into Bernie Madoff for a bunch of money.
Right.
The things they tried to do was sell minority shares, and the biggest selling point was time with Mr. Met. I'm not making this up.
No.
It was like, yes, it was clearly parceled out how much time they could get with Mr. Met and, you know, significant play dates and stuff like that. So they really have in Mr. Met a great icon, and in all honesty, this does hurt the brand a bit.
So why do you think he got all angry and maybe flipped off the fan?
Well, have you ever been to Citi Field in Chase Stadium? There's a lot of angry, cursing New Yorkers there. And people who were around the incident said that there were a crowd of hecklers who were hurling nasty comments about Mr. Met's mother.
Oh,
so
okay.
I didn't even know Mr. Met had a mother, but of course he had. You know,
the
classic question, what came first, the baseball or the mom? I guess the answer is the mom.
All right, Mike, thank you very much for clearing that up.
Did I clear it up? I tried. Thanks.
Sort of. Mike Pesca, host of Slate's podcast, The Gist. right, Mr. Bordahl is here now.
Yes, Ms. Brand, here I am.
Keep your hands where I can see them.
I will try to do that. Well, we had John Cobalt on earlier, conservative talk radio guy of John and Ken fame, who was giving us sort of the Trump supporters' view of the president's decision to pull out of the Paris Accord. Some of our listeners were not very happy that we had him on. We got some tweets like Matthew Palm saying, at KCRW Press Play, you're putting right-wing AM radio shock jocks on now? WTF is wrong with you and at NPR. Michael Darling said, I love the show, but can you please not have con artists like Cobalt on? I had to change the channel when you intro'd him. And Peter Cole said, sorry you got rolled by a climate skeptic guest. Should have asked about drought in California, Hurricane Sandy in New York, etc. So, there you go. I guess they don't want to hear from the other side, some of these people who are listening to us.
Yeah.
California.
It's always good to hear from the other side.
I do as well.
And
I thought it was very interesting.
We're not here to take sides. So
exactly.
There you go.
California State Assembly passed a bill doing away with daylight saving time. We asked our listeners what they think of that idea. Emma Stewart says, yes, I'm all about ending daylight savings time.
Saving.
The KK wrote, daylight savings time needs to die in a fire. It's not only inconvenient, it harms people.
What is happening with the grammar? Listeners!
And Sandra Miriam said, how bad is it that daylight savings time is my passion issue? But, lest you think it's all one-sided, Press Play friend and election Sherpa Jessica Levinson has written a whole opinion piece extolling the virtues of daylight saving time. Check it out in the Sacramento Bee. She said, in a word, a disaster. In two words, an unmitigated disaster.
Well,
getting rid of daylight saving time.
That's where she and I part ways. And we do agree on the correct spelling, which is saving 1S. Thank you very much, Christian Bordahl.
You are welcome.
Have a great weekend, and you have a great weekend. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you on Monday.